difference, as was pointed out, our study today has been given the title, Have We Lived Before, in the form of a question. So we shall approach it from that side. The moment we put questions of this kind, we discover that there are further questions to be asked about the question itself. If we say, have we lived before, to begin with, what is we? What am I who asks the question? Obviously, to use the modern joke, to say, if a Mr. Brown is speaking, say, who is Mr. Brown? The answer is, oh, he was Mrs. Brown's little boy. Now, it's not Mrs. Brown's little boy who lived before, because certainly if he lived before, there is no guarantee that his name was Brown, or indeed even that it was a boy. Perhaps it was a girl. So, what is I? Now, Mr. Crosby once gave a lecture under the title, What Reincarnates? It is reprinted in a little book called Universal Theosophy, which you can see at that book table. Now, in that he said, what reincarnates is a mystery to many minds because they find a difficulty in understanding such a permanency as must stand behind repeated incarnations. See, if we ask a question at all about whether we lived before, and of course consequently whether we are going to live again after death in this body, either way, you are implying that there is something permanent which is capable of existing apart from this body, and if you think a little further, apart from the very personality which this body carries. And not just the physical body, but the whole temperament, the characteristics. There's so much that is involved. In one place in her book, The Key to Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky has distinguished between individuality and personality. And she has pointed out in simple words, if you say, I am I, that's your sense of being an individual. If you say, I am Mr. Brown, that is a complex idea. It's really the I wrapped up in a particular temperament and personality. Why do we say that? Mr. Crosby's comments are very useful here. He says, theosophy presents a larger view in showing that man is not his body, because the body is continually changing. I mean, the child practically doubles its weight in the first 6 months, but it doesn't mean that the identity has doubled or even grown. That man is not his mind, because he's constantly changing his mind. That there is in man a permanency which is the identity throughout all kinds of embodiments. Now this idea of all kinds of embodiments is very interesting. It takes us back to something very fundamental which Mr. Judge said in his chapter on reincarnation in the Ocean of Theosophy. He says, look, if you regard the world as made up of consciousness and substance, spirit and matter, and if that spirit or consciousness, by definition, if it exists at all, is immortal, then how can the two combine? On the one hand, spirit is immortal, on the other hand, matter is indestructible. So far is straightforward. How are the two going to combine? when they do, the same spirit is being embodied in various forms of matter, but matter is indestructible, the forms are not. Any form is matter drawn together under the guidance of a pattern, a controlling purpose, however, whatever it may be. And that's why, actually, even when you leave spirit aside for a moment, matter and forms, the matter persists, but the particular form crumbles. But the same matter is used to make another form. This is called re-embodiment. Now, when you transfer this inevitable relationship, so Mr. Church put it in a couple of sentences, he said, now the moment we postulate a double evolution, physical and spiritual, we have at the same time to admit that it can only be carried on by reincarnation. For alone in reincarnation is the answer to all the problems of life, and in it and karma is the force that will make men pursue in fact the ethics they have in theory. That second implication we'll see later on. But the immediate logic has to be faced. If there is at all anything other than matter in a man, then the whole question arises, how are the two linked together? At one time, there was a great argument in the Western world, in the early centuries of Christianity, about a doctrine which was called pre-existence. There was an argument about whether the soul existed before it was born. Those, for example, who had studied Plato, there were, you know, in the 3rd century AD, there was the great school of the Neoplatonists. To them it was evident that the soul had existed before on other levels, in other places. But the Orthodox Christians did not accept that because they were divided. Some of them at that point, we're talking about 300 AD, at that point some of them still believed in reincarnations, others did not, and the matter was actually only settled around 500 AD at a big council. They could not agree even there, so finally they had to take a vote, and there was a majority decision against reincarnation. And the council said, let this one marvelous doctrine be anathema, and but from there on it became the church policy, as it were, to deny reincarnation. We're saying all this to remind you that historically philosophers, thinkers, religious people have asked the question, again, because they have this feeling that there is something called the soul. Now, in modern days, the situation is difficult because for 100 years or more, there have been very prestigious schools of thought that think that the mind is only an epiphenomenon of matter. That matter has its processes and mind and consciousness simply results from it. Now, if anyone takes this view, if he regards a human being as essentially his body and thinks that the feelings, the mind, all the rest of it is a kind of result, a sort of byproduct of biological processes, then the only logical thing he can believe is that he has lived neither before nor will he live after, that death is the end and that's it. And in that case, the situation is different. But for anyone who thinks of mind, consciousness, soul as a separate, independent factor, thinks that there is more to a man than the results of his physical processes, he has to ask the question, but what is it like in its nature? Now, we won't go into the technical aspect of this, but it has been pointed out by philosophers who did believe in the independence of consciousness, that by its nature, it must be continuous and not liable to be interrupted or ended. Because if there are only two aspects to this universe, consciousness and matter, and if we do not accept that consciousness is the result of matter, then if consciousness is interrupted, there is nothing to restart it. We are not accepting that matter can restart it. So consciousness cannot be interrupted. It can be transformed. It can appear in various ways, but you cannot have an interruption. Sleep does not interrupt it. And so we take one step further and say, death also does not interrupt it. However, for most of us, death does interrupt something else. It interrupts memory. And this is why most of us have difficulties. Now, when HPB was explaining the doctrines of theosophy, the key to theosophy, she put things in a dialogue form, and in those terms, her section on reincarnation or rebirth begins with the subsection, what is memory according to theosophical teaching? Because it's so easy to say, but why don't I remember? Do I remember? That's all very well, but what do we mean by memory? And there are different aspects to memory. Some of them depend upon the physical body and the apparatus, the brain and other constituents of the man. Constituents which are put together as one personality only during this birth. So Mrs. Brown's little boy becomes Tom Brown, so to speak, in virtue of particular tendencies and characteristics that are assembled for this birth. What the Buddhist philosophers would call skandhas, what the modern scientists would talk about a genetic inheritance, what you and I can see happening as the result of the way he is brought up, the way his parents influence him. But in various ways we can see the present personality of the little boy being put together and, as it were, taking a particular shape and characteristics. Naturally, this apparatus cannot tell you anything about what happened before the birth of that body, or the beginning of the process by which this personality is given shape and form. However, there was something. So we come back to the question of what is I? What's the we who remembers or does not remember, who may have existed before the birth of this body or not, who may have lived before or not? What is this I? Now, theosophy, as we said, distinguishes between individuality and personality. We don't wish to be technical about these matters, so there is naturally in philosophy an exposition in terms of many aspects of the human constitution. But we can see that there is the possibility that there is, that a permanent identity can still exert and actually bring into effect some capacities at one time and other capacities at another time. It can use certain instruments and certain vestures surrounding it at one time, other instruments and vestures at another time. And the relation between the permanent or immortal soul or ego on the one hand and the personality which you see here and now is of this sort. In fact, more than one place, Madame Levetsky used the simile or analogy of an actor performing many roles. She said, yes, during one lifetime, you appear as a particular kind of person. That is like you are performing one role. But when an actor has finished performing that role, he remains himself. Then after some time, he performs another. And during the performance of the second role, he is not likely to bring up things which belong to the other role. In fact, if he did, he would cause difficulties and confusion. Also, a good actor, immersed in the performance of his role, may almost, not literally, but almost forget that he is Mr. So-and-so and think and feel and act as though he is Othello or Hamlet or whoever it is. Of course, in the background there is the awareness. H.P.B. remarks that in our lives, unfortunately, this ignorance of who he really is, you know, during the time you are performing Hamlet, you forget who you are, the actor. In our lives, this is unfortunately too real. We got so involved in performing the role which is our personality in this life that we simply have forgotten what we are in ourselves, independently of this particular personality. So you see, the whole question of have we lived before depends on whether we think that there is an identity, a person, an individual, who's not simply the whole personality as we now know it. Now, is there any difficulty about this? There should not be. It's the great emphasis of the Buddha's teaching that if you look at yourself, you see a continual wheel of change. As Mr. Crosby was pointing out, your body changes, you change your mind, as we know we are in different moods at different times, which means our emotional conditions are different at different times. You speak of somebody, you say he has mellowed as he has grown older, used to be very rough and temperamental as a young man, now he is quieter and milder. People change in what we call their personality. People who have serious personality disturbances, as they are called by the psychiatrist, are sometimes cured and emerge back into normality. So this thing which keeps changing is not exactly our identity. We use it, it's closely associated with us, but we are not these things. And of course, if anyone has practiced meditation, he knows that the very first step is to withdraw from identification with the physical body. If I think that this is the body, meditation simply, I mean, you're blocked. It's simply not possible to begin meditation on that level. You have to withdraw and stop being conscious of yourself as the body. So, in various ways, even simple folk like us, I mean, not sages and so on, are really aware of this, the truth of what the Buddha taught. That what you call yourself is really a flow. It's really a stream of changing conditions and it is not a lasting entity. This is at least the first step of perception of what is meant by the doctrine of anatma or anatta as it's called in Pali. Now, if we grasp this, then we can also see that in this long stream of changes, one thing happening as the result of another, the death of the physical body is not and does not have to be final. Because the whole of the man was not the result of the physical body anyway. When he lost weight, we said, oh, he's not been well. We didn't say he has become less. If he gained weight, we did not think that there was an addition to his humanity. If a young man went abroad and acquired lots of degrees and came back with half the alphabet, as they say, after his name, did his mother or his father think he had become somebody else? Well, no. So, this combination of an underlying permanence and a constant change on the visible level, it has to be understood. Once we see that, there's no difficulty about postulating. We're not going further at this minute, but there is no difficulty about postulating a real being who exists even before the body is born, and who in fact, as it were, enters the body like an actor assuming the costume, etc., for the performance of a particular role. Now, of course, there is this difficulty about memory. As we said, that's because there are many kinds of memory. The simple physical memory, in any case, is very unreliable. After all, you don't really remember what you had for breakfast on the 16th of December 1999, if I were to ask you suddenly. You probably don't remember. But what you ate has gone into you. It sustained your body and energy for the necessary time, and so forth. As the little old rhyme says, whatever misty eats becomes misty. So that yes. In that sense, the body remembers your old breakfast. But you have no conscious memory of it. But there is another kind of memory. Technically for it, the word reminiscence is used. Now, we don't wish to be obstinate about words, because other schools of writers have used the word in different ways. The psychologists sometimes use it in a very peculiar technical way, so we don't have to worry about that. In theosophical and philosophical literature, it is used as the equivalent of the memory of the soul. Now, if this is what we want to talk about, then yes. So, in the Key to Theosophy, when Madame Blavatsky is arguing about the question of memory, she says, to get convinced of the fact of reincarnation and past lives, one must put oneself in rapport with one's real permanent ego, not one's evanescent memory. There are these different kinds of memory. On this level, my memory isn't reliable even about my own early years. It's not reliable about my breakfast last week. And as age goes on, sometimes it becomes unreliable in the about the simplest and most familiar things. The people who can't remember names, the people who forget very simple things. The fact that we don't remember has nothing to do whether the thing exists or existed or not. But then, if we don't remember, how do we know that it existed at all? Now, this is the important thing. Now, here we regard, for a moment, reincarnation as a necessary hypothesis. And the necessary hypothesis arises because when you look at life as it is, you feel that there must be some previous explanation of why things are as they are. That is why in one place Madame Blavatsky writes, and you can see that she writes with feeling, and she says, it is the individuality who suffers through his personality, and it is this and this alone that can account for the terrible, still only apparent, injustice in the distribution of lots in life to man. When your modern philosophers will have succeeded in showing to us a good reason why so many apparently innocent and good men are born only to suffer during a whole lifetime, why so many are born poor unto starvation in the slums of great cities, abandoned by fate and men. Why, while these are born in the gutter, others open their eyes to light in palaces? While a noble birth and fortune seem often given to the worst of men and only rarely to the worthy? While there are beggars whose inner selves are pierced to the highest and noblest of men? When this and much more is satisfactorily explained by either your philosophers or theologians, then only, but not till then, you will have the right to reject the theory of reincarnation. the highest and grandest of poets have dimly perceived this truth of truths. Shelley believed in it. Shakespeare must have thought of it when writing on the worthlessness of birth. Remember his words. Why should my birth keep down my mounting spirit? Are not all creatures subject unto time? There's legions now of beggars on the earth that their original did spring from kings, and many monarchs now whose fathers were the riffraff of their age. Alter the word fathers into egos and you will have the truth. This is HPB's last sentence in that section after she's quoted Shakespeare. So it depends not on the role but on the actor. It depends not on the visible personality, which is only a collection of many factors, but on the lasting ego. In terms of that ego, we can explain why you have this strange distribution of everything, of inborn qualities, intelligence, appearance, health, and also circumstances in life, money, access to education, all those things. If we have not lived before, then of course, in all these matters, there is a purely random distribution. For no reason on earth, one man is intelligent and the other is a cretin. One man has a comfortable home life and encouragement to study well at school and college, and another, perhaps possessed of a very high IQ, can't get hold of a notebook or a textbook. In this part of India, there used to be stories, I remember, of people who could study only by sitting beneath the road lamps of the municipality. But a few of them managed to overcome this enormous hardship and become really learned men. And there are instances of this. So there is really no explanation at all of the way personalities are, or the way distribution of circumstances of life is. Unless we think of a being pre-existing who was already there and who has done something or the other, set causes in motion which have produced these results. So you see, argument about memory is all very well, but reincarnation cannot be understood except together with the twin doctrine of karma. Because what we are understanding or trying to see is a whole pattern of life, of how human life is visualized by a great spiritual traditions. And they see it as a great soul, a permanent being, undergoing experience. Now, once you are undergoing experience, it must be limited. I mean, if I am going to study in Bombay, it means I am not studying in Delhi. You have to be somewhere. It has to be at a certain time. There are particular, but why? Why these qualities, why these factors and not some others? The suggestion of the doctrine of karma is that it is the previous actions, not of the person that you see, he wasn't there, but the previous actions of the permanent being inside him, the permanent soul within, that lead from one set of factors to the next. Just as within this life, if I feed the poor body with junk, in a few years' time, it will show a certain come down in its energy and health. If I treat it well, intelligently, it will show stamina and energy. But what we see happening in the lives that we can observe, the rule of law, the moving from cause to effect, the great spiritual traditions say that the same thing happens as between one lifetime and the next and the next and the next. Why? Because the whole thing serves a purpose. Now, in our devotional reading, that was a poet's way of putting it, but you noticed how consistently he put the whole thing. He said, he makes the Buddha say that is. The books say, well, my brothers, because this doctrine was not new with the Buddha, it already existed. The books say, well, my brothers, each man's life, the outcome of his former living is. The bygone wrongs bring forth sorrows and woes. The bygone right breeds bliss. That which is so he reaped. See yonder fields, the sesamum was sesamum, the corn was corn. The silence and the darkness knew, so is a man's fate born. That's a beautiful turn of a poetic phrase. The silence and the darkness knew. That is, though we do not know, the thing is not random, the thing is not accidental. In the silence and the darkness, as it were, where the seed is beneath the earth, it's still that particular seed. And the seed of sesamum is going to grow up as a sesamum plant. It's not going to grow up as something else. The sesamum was sesamum, the corn was corn. So on the one hand, so we have to say, oh yes, there is so much that is mysterious, so much that we don't know. But on the other hand, philosophically, we can be sure that the cause produces its due effect. And that human life has a pattern, purpose. How does it proceed? If he shall labor rightly, rooting these and planting wholesome seedlings where they grow, fruitful and fair and clean the ground shall be, and rich the harvest due. This is important because no matter how tightly bound your present circumstances and position may be, this means that what you do now will change it. That from here you can move onwards. If he who liveth, learning whence woe springs, endureth patiently, striving to pay his utmost debt for ancient evils done, in love and truth alway, if making none to lack, he thoroughly purge the lie and lust of self forth from his blood, suffering all meekly, rendering for offense nothing but grace and good, and so on. If he fulfills all these conditions, then what happens? He dying leaveth as the sum of him a life count closed, whose ills are dead and quit, whose good is quick and mighty, far and near, so that fruits follow it. No need hath such to live as ye name life. That which began in him when he began is finished. He hath wrought the purpose through of what did make him man. Now, this is the point. Yes, there is a beginning and an end, which is not the beginning and end of the body in which we find ourselves today, but there is or can be a beginning and an end of the cycle of births and deaths. Because that cycle of births and deaths serves a purpose. This is something that the immortal ego wished to do. Patanjali put it by saying that the universe exists for the sake of the soul's experience and emancipation. The book that we're studying on Saturday, Through the Gates of Gold, speaks of the soul as wanting sensation in a technical sense. That is, not only pleasure, not only pain, but all forms of experience, that it's in this life in order to collect all that as a kind of raw material for its own inner growth and development. Even painful experiences are part of the raw material. Pleasant experiences can be part of the raw material. It's a question of learning, expanding consciousness, developing potential powers and faculties which are there in every human soul. as the great text, the voice of the silence says, look within, thou art Buddha. But it's not only that someday you will become, but look within, thou art Buddha. Within every human being, every human soul, there are the same powers as produced the great enlightened one. So, it's a question of developing, unfolding. To do this, you need experience, you need to go through this outer world. But within, there is something that is not affected by all this. Technically, this is put by saying that karma never reaches the Atman or the spiritual self. It is above the whole level of change. It undergoes changes of experience. It undergoes changes of the various koshas, the sheets of the soul as they are called. You know, they are listed in Indian philosophies. You speak of the Annamaya kosha, the Pranamaya kosha, and so forth. But all these change, but the true self within doesn't change. It watches, it learns. No? This process is going on. So long as the process is incomplete, there is what is called the desire for sensation. Through the gates of gold speaks of this. It says nature is a welcoming and kind mother. So long as someone wants to come and rest with her, she will not push him out. That is, as long as the soul has this desire for experience in the outer world, this which is technically called Trishna in Sanskrit and Tanha in Pali. So long as it's there, the world, nature, Prakriti, the laws of the universe, however you put it, these will provide a scene, a stage where that experience can take place. In fact, you will be compelled to come back to this until the work is finished, because this work needs that arena, that stage, place of outer experience. And there are debts to pay. As we go along acquiring experience and acting in this world, we create debts towards other beings. We use them. We have to also be of use to them. As modern people like to say rather cynically, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Well, that is also true at a much higher level, that we are all interdependent, that we all depend on one another, and you cannot form a link at one time because it suits your needs at the time, your experiences, and then drop that link when you please. Here in life, people do that, yes. When they are risen in life, as they call it, they want to drop old acquaintances who are a bit shabby or whatever. In real life, you can't do that. You're born again. And as various idioms in Indian languages say, when a child is troublesome or difficult in the home, the harassed mother might say, "Oh, I don't know what enemy of a past incarnation has been born to me." Well, it might be literally true. But anyway, the relationships continue. What we owe has to be paid sometime. What others owe to us will be paid sometime. We'll get unexpected help, we'll get unexpected friendship. That will also come. So there's so much to our life that we don't control, because it is a perfectly logical, lawful result of causes that we don't now remember about. But unless there is a great web of this sort, our present life does not make sense. So, this twin doctrine of reincarnation and karma is simply a kind of unavoidable hypothesis to make sense of life itself, to make sense of psychology, to make sense of the social situation, to make sense of the great human perceptions of tragedy and comedy, both. The whole thing doesn't make sense. Now, it's all very well to evolve a philosophical theory or a philosophical hypothesis to remove the technical difficulties about memory by saying, look, you can't expect that this brain should remember what was impressed not on this brain, but on whatever brain existed in a prior life. Yes, you can say all this. But still, one wants confirmation, isn't it? Purely theoretical structure. And that confirmation is given by some exceptional people. In the nature of things, you can't expect this to happen all the time. But it has happened now and then that very great beings have said unequivocally that they remember their past lives. I'm not talking of little newspaper stories that turn up once every 6 months. But there are beings like the Buddha who could say this. And once we have understood the philosophical rightness of it, the consistency of the thing, then we can take their word for it. There is no inherent difficulty. We see that as a matter of philosophy, we need this hypothesis, and then it is confirmed by what is said by very great beings. Why are they able to say this? They have explained also the why they are able to say it. They have said, look, in the ordinary way, the consciousness of the man working here and now through the brain and the body is not very well attuned to the original consciousness which launched the whole cycle of birth and death. The memory of the spiritual ego, the memory of the immortal soul, and the memory of the personal man working here in the brain, these two are not very well attuned to each other. But as spiritual discipline proceeds, as the man begins, as the poet says, to purge the lie and lust of self forth from his blood. That is, as he stops identifying himself with these very changeable external things, as the actor stops being so preoccupied with the role he is playing and can step back, as it were, during an interval and remember that he's Sir Laurence Olivier, not Hamlet. When that becomes possible, then the two levels can come to an attunement. They will not be the same, obviously, but they can come to an attunement. And the immortal ego can impress its memory on the personal consciousness. There is, as it were, there are states in which there is synchronous vibration between the higher spiritual nature, the permanent immortal soul, and the kind of consciousness which is working here and now through the Nama-Rupa. In the case of someone like the Buddha, this is not a special thing which happens in special hours, because he is never subject to the illusion at all that he is this outer body and the personality. At intermediate stages, people practicing spiritual discipline may reach up to that attunement at certain times in meditation, at certain times during Sushupti every night, as the Upanishad says. But this is something which comes and goes, it's not reliable. But there comes a time, we are told, this in Buddhist tradition is called Sambhasambodhi, of which one aspect is that spiritual realization of what you really are includes total memory of all that you have gone through in the way of experience in the manifested universe. Time is running out. It would be interesting to see how Plato applies this to certain special things like the experience of beauty. But he keeps on thinking about the below the surface memory of the soul, of all that it has experienced on higher levels and previous states of existence. So because this happens, and it can happen, this is what Madame Blavatsky meant by the rapport which has to be established with the immortal ego. That when you are tuned to what your real identity is like, then nothing is lost. No memory is ever lost. It's all there, and it is all recalled by beings attaining to what is called self-realization or Sammasambodhi or enlightenment. They remember the whole thing. And that is why in theosophy it is said that when you take the whole pattern into account, then you remember this is something that Madame Blavatsky said about life as such, And as seen in the light of these doctrines of reincarnation and karma. For logic, consistency, profound philosophy, divine mercy and equity, this doctrine of reincarnation has not its equal on earth. It's a belief in a perpetual progress for each incarnating ego or divine soul, in an evolution from the outward into the inward, from the material to the spiritual, arriving at the end of each stage at absolute unity with the divine principle. From strength to strength, from the beauty and perfection of one plane to the greater beauty and perfection of another, with accessions of new glory, of fresh knowledge and power in each cycle, such is the destiny of every ego, which thus becomes its own savior in each world and incarnation. If this life were all, then in many respects it would indeed be poor and mean. But regarded as a preparation for the next sphere of existence, it may be used as the golden gate through which we may pass, not selfishly and alone, but in company with our fellows